Yesterday we had a beautiful introduction to this problem of DNA denaturation by Ralph and Lehan. So what I want is to build on that and go a little bit into more detail and discuss some problems of excluded volumes which enter into this question. So I will not repeat what was said yesterday, but just a couple of words just to set the framework. So we are talking about the denaturation transition, thermal denaturation transition of DNA. That is, we have this double strand, we heat it up, and then we start getting these bubbles which fluctuate in time, and then as you heat it up, eventually at some point you have the two strands separate, and you get a transition from this double-stranded to single-stranded, or the helix-to-coil transition. And that's the DNA denaturation transition or melting transition. Now, if you look at the order parameter of this transition, this is the fraction, theta, the fraction of bounded pairs. And clearly, as you, the fraction of bounded pairs at low temperatures is high, and it gets down as you heat it up. And this is directly measurable by optical means. There is an absorption line of UV of 260 nanometers, which is preferentially absorbed in the single-stranded than the double-stranded, and therefore by measuring the absorption, you directly get a measure of theta. And so this was discussed yesterday, and usually a typical graph looks something like that. This is what is plotted here is basically 1 minus theta versus the temperature, and this is the red line where you see a curve like that. So it, if you look at theta, you have to just take the 1 minus that. And what you see is a series of steps, which are, so that's in the red line, and the black line is just the derivatives, the theta dt, where just to accentuate where the transitions are. And what you see is these transitions, which are attributed to the heterogeneity of the sample. As we know, there are these two kinds of bonds, AT bonds and CG bonds, and the AT bonds are generally weaker bonds, and therefore they try to melt at a lower temperature. So if you have regions where you have higher concentration of AT bonds, they will try and melt here, and other regions will melt there, and etc. People were interested in this kind of problem in the early 60s because this curve gives a fingerprint of the sequence of the DNA, because each DNA, if you just change the sequence, you'll get a similar curve, but the position of the steps and the height of the steps will be different, and it gives you a lot of statistical information about the sequence. And people try to interpret that and to get some information about the sequence. But what I'm interested in at this point is just look at this. You can look at this each step here as a kind of transition in of a finite segment. This is the melting of a finite segment. So suppose you have a segment here which has more AT bonds, and it melts here. And then you see this is a rather sharp peak, rather sharp transition that takes place here, and which is usually interpreted as a first order phase transition. That is, it's a kind of jump in the, you know, this bubble just opens abruptly. And it's also associated with a little of hysteresis. That is, if you go up and down, this position of the line shifts a little bit. And that's usually interpreted experimentally as a first order phase transition. Now, and yesterday, Lehan told us a lot about how to take this heterogeneity into account and what to do with it. What I want to talk today about is to look at the homogeneous system. That is, look at a homopolymer. And there, what we expect is, we don't expect this kind of step kind of function, but we accept a smoother curve, schematically something like that. And the question is, how should it look in general? Is it a smooth curve, like a second order phase transition will go like that, or a first order phase transition with a jump at the transition? And experimentally, from what we saw before, we expect this kind of curve to be first order. Okay. So the issue is take a homopolymer and start and look.
What are the experiments with zero bits of transition region?
Sorry, what are the experiments?
You say experimental, but they expect it to be first order.
Well, it's this kind of experiment with hysteresis. Well, you see, here it's a melting of a finite region. So they are round, it's rounded by the fact that it's a finite region. And there is some hysteresis which strongly indicate that it's first order. No, 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 but this is not, this is just, you know, you have to go up and down and, you know, it's not shown here, the hysteresis. Okay. Now, the theoretical approach to this problem of the homopolymer was introduced in the early 60s, and there are many people involved in this, developing this model, the basic model, starting with Tim in 1960, Schneer-Lifson, and many other people. Eventually, the model was solved in 1966, and that's why it's known as the Polan-Chiraga, and therefore it's known as the Polan-Chiraga model, although it was introduced long before. Now what they find is, and I'll talk about this model a bit longer in a few minutes, what they find is that the melting transition is continuous, where the order parameter goes like T minus T melting to the power beta with beta equals 1. So that's the basic result of the Polan-Chiraga model, which was discussed briefly yesterday. I will just go a little bit more into it. Now in this model, I'll be very explicit in a few minutes, there is no self-avoidance of the chain is not taken into account when you calculate entropies. And that's the main thing which was neglected, and that's the main result that one gets. Now this model was, right after it was solved by Polan-Chiraga, it was extended by Michael Fischer, again in 66, who introduced self-avoidance, but only partially. He introduced self-avoidance only within each loop, but he did not take into account interaction between the various loops. Now, when you do that, and then you can extend the Polan-Chiraga model, taking this into account very easily, as we'll see, the transition becomes sharper, but it's still second order. It's sharper in the sense that the order parameter goes like T minus T melting to the power beta, but beta is not 1, but roughly a quarter. So it's a sharper transition, but not quite first order, as seemed to be indicated by the experiments. Now, and at the end, so I'll describe these two approaches, and at the end, I'll discuss a recent extension that we were involved in, where one takes into account the self-avoidance fully, also the self-avoidance between loops, not only within a loop and between loops, and this makes the transition first order.
What is the loop in your definition?
I'll define everything in a minute. Okay, so, and you can find the paper which goes with it is that Yariv Kafer is a PhD student at Weizmann, Luca Pelliti was on sabbatical last year with us, and you can find all references and whatever in this publication.
Sorry, is there experimental data on the homopolymers?
There is some experimental data on homopolymers, and you see sharp transition. It's even there are experimental data on short sequences, and then they increase the length of the sequence, and you can see that.
You even have the finite space scale.
Yeah, well, don't get carried out. Yeah.
What kind of experimental system would that be on a homopolymer?
It's kind of, I have the reference, I can...
If it's really homopolymer, then they have the same...
No, it has, I know. It's the same kind of bonds, but it's there is some randomness in it. It's all AT, kind of AT bonds, but...
All AT, but it's random AT?
I think so, yeah. I think it's... I can get you the reference later on. Okay, so the Polan-Chiraga model, which was introduced yesterday, I want to go a little bit deeper into it before going. So the model is the following. You look at the microscopic configuration of the DNA at some temperature. So the microscopic configuration consists of a sequence of bound segments and loops which are open, you know, and it just you have a sequence like that. And you want to calculate what is the Boltzmann weight associated with this kind of sequence. So first of all, you look at the bound segment, and you assume that there is an energy minus E per bond for the bonding. It really doesn't matter whether you're stacking or in this kind of approach. It's really very robust. If you are interested in the order of the transition, these kind of details are not going to change much. So if you have a segment of length L and energy per bond is minus E, there is a Boltzmann weight for each segment which goes like E to the beta E L. Okay? Now, we assume that, in this Poulenc-Chiragi model, the bending of this double-stranded thing does not take place. That is, it's as if the persistent length go to infinity. In fact, the persistent length is finite, but again, it doesn't really matter. We just take one road, don't take into account bending energies and things like that. No, infinity. It's just the length. The persistent length. Sorry? That's in the double strand. In the double strand. Yeah, I was talking about the double strand. You know that. Okay. For the loops, on the other hand, here it's LP is equal 0 or 1 or whatever. There is no energy associated with the loop. And it is assumed within this Poulenc-Chiragi model that there is no bending energy. So a loop can just bend and you don't pay anything. So it's as if you have a persistent length which is 1. In reality, it's a few tens. So that's the loop. So look, there's no energy, but there is a degeneracy, there is entropy. That is, you can just bend it and you get entropy. So in all, the picture is the following. You get straight segments of double-stranded DNA and then some loops which are can bend, and then another stretch and another like that, and that's a microscopic configuration of the system. Now, to estimate the entropy of a loop, this is number of configurations of a loop, then this is just some power s to the L, a loop of length L. S is some geometrical factor, it depends on the dimensionality. If you do it in two dimensions, say you absorb the DNA, it's something, and in three dimensions, it's something else. But it's some factor, really doesn't matter. But the point is that there is an L to this power C down there, and this C in the Poulenc-Chiragi approach is just D over 2. D is the dimension of the system, where again, in calculating this entropy, self-avoidance is not taken into account. So it can be self-intersecting, and it's just a kind of phantom loop. Okay. And the way to see this factor L to the C, it was mentioned yesterday a couple of times, why it's L to the C. Clearly, if you have a random chain with no self-avoidance, it's go like S to the L, the number of states. On the other hand, if you have, you want to make a loop, you want the end to come back to the origin, and you have a random chain, the radius of gyration is just square root of L, so the volume goes like L to the power D over 2, so the probability for it to go back is 1 over the volume, and therefore the total number of states is just S to the L divided by this volume, which is S to the L divided by L to the C, where C is D over 2. So that's the Poulenc-Chiragi entropy. Now, what do you have to do? Now you have to combine these two ingredients in order to calculate the free energy, and the net result at the end is the following. Just let me quote the result. It turns out that there are two parameters here in this Poulenc-Chiragi model, S and C. S is just non-universal parameter, you know, it's S to the L, the entropy, and S determines the transition point. But the nature of the transition is determined by the parameter C, and only by C. It turns out that if C is less than 1, there is no transition. If C is between 1 and 2, the transition is continuous. And if C is larger than 2, the transition is first order. And since C is D over 2, in three dimensions, it's 3 halves, Poulenc-Chiragi conclude that it's a continuous phase transition. Now, that shows that it's very difficult to really play with the order of the transition. You can add all kinds of ingredients like bending energies and finite persistent length and whatever. This C is a universal quantity. You have to go to a different universality class if you really want to change C and to get a different type of phase transition. So that's the net result. Now, let me spend a few minutes. I'm not going to really derive.
C equals 1, so there's if you set it equal to 1, there's again no transition?
Yes, there's no transition. I'll show it to you. Okay,
One question. You neglect the entropy, the part which is double, which is in a helicoidal form.
Right.
You said that you approximate the persistence length as infinite.
Right.
So you neglect any kind of entropy.
Right. You can do that, you can add it, it doesn't change. No.
But I think the real way would be, because you, in fact, when you open up the double strand, you have two single strands.
Right.
If you count the entropy of both,
I think that will
change your C, if the double strand is completely inflexible. So I think that the normal argument is that it's the relative position that counts. That will give you only a single random walk exponent. But if the double chain is completely rigid, then you don't have any sort of entropy.
I don't know. But once you have a loop, a loop of length 2L. You have a loop of length 2L, and then you look at the entropy of that, and this is the entropy. It's a loop of total length of 2L.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let me, I will just outline what goes into the derivation of this result of Paul and Chiraga. I think it's very important, and it's very basic, therefore I'll outline it in some way. So what you have to do is the following. You have to take, now we have the basic ingredients, so we have to calculate the partition sum. How do we calculate the partition sum? We take a microscopic configuration, which is composed of an alternating sequence of bounded segments and loops, and we have to put the Boltzmann weight associated with them. So the Boltzmann weight associated with the segment here is just W is the Boltzmann e to the beta epsilon. So the Boltzmann weight is W to the power L1, just very simple. On the other hand, if we have a loop of length, say, 2L4, this segment is L4, but the loop is size 2L4, then we have this omega of 2L4, where omega is just the entropy of loop of length 2L4. And the total Boltzmann weight of this configuration is therefore W to the power L1 times omega of 2L2 times W to the power L3 times omega, etc., etc., etc. So that's the Boltzmann weight. And all these Li's have to sum up to capital L, which is the total length of the polymer. And then what we have to do is to take this weight and to sum over all possible configurations, all possible microscopic configurations. That is, all possible Li's and all possible number of possible loops. Okay, we can have a configuration without any loop at all, configuration with two loops, three loops, so this is the K, which number gives the number of loops, and you have to do this kind of sum. Now, to do this sum, you have to notice that there is a constraint that the sum goes to L, and as usual, that makes it more difficult to calculate this sum, and the way to deal with it is to go to the grand canonical ensemble, that is, remove this constraint and calculate the grand partition sum. Okay, so this constraint is removed by introducing the fugacity, Z, and one calculates the grand partition sum, and then everything decouples, and one can perform the calculation and calculate the grand partition sum. The average length of the polymer is just given, as usual, by D log gamma D log Z. That's the average length of the polymer. Now, it turns out that you can calculate, or you can express this grand partition sum very simply in the following way. there are two functions, V of Z and U of Z. Now, V of Z is the grand partition sum of a segment. That is, since the problem now decouples, so you have either segments or loops. So take just a segment, and then sum over all possible lengths of that segment. So the Boltzmann weight is W to the L times Z to the L, segment of length L, and then you sum over L. So this is, take a segment, and you sum over all possible Boltzmann weights of that, and you get the grand partition sum of a segment. On the other hand, U of Z is the grand partition sum of a loop. That is, you take the entropy of a loop of size L times Z to the L and sum over L, and that's U of Z. And it turns out that you can express the grand partition sum of the total system in the following way. It's just 1 over 1 minus V times U. This is very easy to see. Basically, you can, it's just a diagrammatic. You can do it this way if you want, where you have here a V factor each time you see a line, and the U factor whenever you see a loop, and the V, U, V, and then V, U, V, U, V, etc. So you have a geometric series with U times V, and basically that's what you get. There is something in the numerator, but it's not important. So that's the grand partition sum of the problem. Okay, so what do you have to do with it? Sorry? Yeah. Okay, so what you have to do is calculate now L. L is the length of the system, and you have to express the fugacity in terms of L, and L is just d log gamma d log z. That's the length of the polymer. But now we are interested in the question of phase transition in this polymer, and therefore clearly we are going to find it. This is not going to work out. It's not. And you are interested in the limit L goes to infinity. You want infinitely long polymer. If you want to study the question of phase transition, and you see that L goes to infinity, this implies that this denominator here goes to zero. So U times V is equal to one. That gives you Z as a function of temperature. Omega is the temperature. Is E to the beta. Epsilon, so that gives you the chemical, the fugacity as a function of temperature, and that gives you all thermodynamic functions you want, and you can, by taking derivatives, for example, you can calculate, for example, you can get the order parameter just by taking the derivative of Z with respect to omega. You know, that's just some thermodynamic relation. So once you solve this equation, you get the fugacity as a function of temperature, then you get everything you want. How do you solve it? So basically you have to solve the following equation. V times U is equal to 1. And V is a geometrical series. G is a trivial geometrical series. While U is almost geometrical series, there is some algebraic correction here, but it is. And you want to solve this equation. And as I said, this is the result. But I want to show you how you solve it and how you get this result that depends on C. Okay, so the way to see it is really very simply. You want to solve the equation U is 1 over Z. 1 over V, sorry. Where 1 over V is just 1 over this geometrical series sum, and U is this. Now what is U? Let's consider first the case C less than 1, less than or equal to 1. Clearly, sorry? You have this L to the C. Clearly it diverges for sufficiently large Z when Z times S is larger than 1, and it's finite below. Now, at the transition point, when Z times S is equal to 1, the series is 1 over L to the C, and since C is less than 1, it diverges, and therefore U goes something like that. What is V? V, or 1 over V, is just 1 over Z minus 1. So here is 1 over V, and here is U, and you have a solution. This is Z as a function of omega, the temperature. And the temperature enters only in this function V. Now, as you change the temperature, you change this curve, and you get Z as a function of omega, and you get basically the solution. Now it turns out that omega, 1 over omega is the point where it hits here. 1 omega is e to the minus beta e. And therefore, when t goes from 0 to infinity, 1 over omega goes from 0 to 1. So basically what you have is you have this curve of 1 over v. It starts at low temperature here, and then you just go up, up, until 1 over omega goes to 1. So you get a smooth curve. There's nothing, z as a function of omega is a smooth function, nothing, no singularity, no phase transition, and that's the result for c less than 1. Now what happens when c is between 1 and 2? Now what you see, the function u converges at the transition, so it's finite. But the derivative diverges. So it comes, the function u comes with diverging slope here. So, and again you repeat this exercise and you have this function v and you just change 1 over omega and you go up, and when you hit this point you get the phase transition. And this phase transition is continuous since this slope is continuous. It goes to zero, basically, this slope. And therefore, the order parameter goes to zero as you approach here, and you get a second order phase transition. Yeah? It turns out that you can calculate the order parameter that goes like t minus tm to the beta, where beta is this 2 minus c over c minus 1, where c is the c that we talked about. That's the beta. And if you put here c is equal to 3 halves, you get the beta is equal to 1 of Poland and Chiraga. Now clearly when c is larger than 2, the function u hits here at the finite slope, and when you get the phase transition is first order, and that's it. Okay. So that's the result of Poland-Chiraga. It shows you that this parameter c enters very crucially in it, and everything depends on this parameter in terms of the order of the transition. Now, the extension, I go to the extension of Michael Fischer, which was very simple. He just did the same thing, except he said, well, the loop is going to be a self-avoiding loop rather than simple loop. So everything goes the same, except the entropy now goes like s to the l to the l to the c, while c is d times nu, where nu is the length scale exponent of the self-avoiding random walk. That's rather than half a d. It is replaced by the true exponent of the random walk, which is known to be 3/4 exactly in two dimensions and about 0.6 in three dimensions. So therefore, if you look at, let me put a table here, the Poland-Chiraga versus Fischer result is the following. In d equals 2, the Poland-Chiraga gives you c is equal to 1, and Fischer gives you the 1.5. In d equals 3, it's 3 halves, and here it's about 1.8. And there is an epsilon expansion that in 4 minus epsilon near 4 dimensions, it's 2 minus half epsilon, here it's 2 minus quarter epsilon. So in all these dimensions, the c is less than 2, which means that the transition is continuous. Okay, so that's where the problem stood. And now I want to discuss the issue of how you take into account the interaction between loops. So I want to take into account the interaction between loops. So I want to do the following exercise. Suppose we have a single loop inside the rest of the chain. Okay, so this represents the rest of the chain, these two lines. Now, this rest of the chain, in any microscopic configurations, also has many loops. Okay? But let's ignore it for a minute. Let's ignore it and assume that it's just a line. Clearly, by the way, if you introduce self-avoidance in the problem, you are going to increase C. Why? Because when this loop is embedded in a chain and you want to take into account the self-avoidance not only within the loop but between the loop and the rest of the chain take some of the room away, and therefore you have less available configurations, and therefore it means that C should be larger. Okay?
So the rest of the chain?
Sorry?
You were assuming initially they were sort of the consistent length was infinite, so they would be the rod.
Yeah. But, so okay. Yeah, I'm getting to it. So I'm just trying to, first to argue that C has to increase. I mean, it goes in the right direction. The question is whether it will increase enough to pass 2 or not.
Now, I'm not sure about that. I mean, if you have a polymer solution, I mean, a dense polymer solution, you know.
Yeah, it's you know, because you have this S to the L up there, and things can go through the S to the L. So it's not, I would say, a very good argument, but I think it's very intuitive. But I'll show that that's what happens. So
can just go only to the S to the L.
It can just go by increasing S. But that's not what happens. But that's actually not what happens. Okay, so the rest of the chain, I neglect the internal structure of the rest of the chain, and I'm assuming it's just a chain without loops. Now, so the rest of the chain is composed of this and the loops and this and the loops and this and the loops. So I'm assuming it's a flexible, you know, it's a flexible object, and I want to look at the self-avoidance between this and the rest of the chain. Now, if you take into account the loops that appear, take place in the rest of the chain, it will increase the effect even further. So because this will mean that this opens and you have here, you know, it has to avoid 2 strings rather than 1 in some regions, and so the self-avoidance will be even a stronger effect. So we want to, the question we want to ask is the following. Suppose you have a configuration like that, where this is a loop, this is the rest of the chain. What is the number of configurations of this, a number of possible configurations of this diagram? Okay, self-avoiding. That is, it self-avoid itself. Okay, so the question is clear, and if we can bring it to the form that we had before, S to the L over L to the C, where we can calculate C, then we can we do what we want. Okay, now I want to quote a result. To do that, I want to quote a result which was derived by on a general result on a polymer network works, which was derived by a group of people around Duplantier since the middle 80s, and there are many people involved in that. Okay, the result is very simple, so let me quote it. The result is the following. Suppose you have a network of polymers with, you know, lengths L1, L2, L3, whatever, a general network. And so such that the sum over Li is L, capital L, that's the total length of the problem. You ask, what is the number of states of this network given that it's self-avoiding? Okay, that's the question. And the answer is the following, in the limit, in the thermodynamic limit, that is where all Li's are go to infinity, keeping the total length, you know, keeping the ratio Li over L fixed, is the following. It goes like S to the to the power L, so it's like we had before, S to the L, L is the total length of the system, times L to the power gamma G minus 1. This is minus C that we had before, except that this exponent depends on the topology of the graph. This gamma G depends only on the topology of the graph. And there is a scaling function, which it depends only on the ratios, but if the ratios are fixed, this is just, when you go to the thermodynamic limit, you get this kind of behavior. So the behavior, the entropy of a polymer network, the algebraic correction to it depends only on the topology of the graph and not on details. It does not depend on the ratios of these lengths and whatever, unless they go to zero. So this is the result. And they give you gamma G, this exponent. And gamma G, as I said, it depends only on the topology of the graph. And it's the following. It's 1 minus D dimension of the system, nu is the exponent of self-avoiding random walk, times L. L is the number of loops. So if we have in this graph, here we have 1 loop. So L is the number of loops. Then, plus sum over sigma n times nn, where sigma n is some numbers that they have to give to you, and m sub n is the number of vertices of order capital N. So here in this particular example, we have one loop. We have two vertices of order 3, so N3 is equal to 2. We have one vertex of order 4, N4 is equal to 1. And we have, dangling bond like that is a vertex of order 1, so we have N1 is equal to 4. We have four lines we just end. Okay? And sigma N are numbers that they have to supply. So once you have the sigma N and you have the graph, you know what to do. And sigma N, it turns out, is calculable exactly in two dimensions. That's from conformal invariance theory. They get this expression. Then they can also do epsilon expansion for the sigma N's near four dimensions. Near the four dimensions, sigma N go to zero at four because this is self-avoidance, and self-avoidance effects go vanish in the term in near d equals four. And so therefore, they all start with some expansion like that. So and then you can sum it, do the approximants, and approximate it in three dimensions. So now we are basically done.
David?
Yes.
This calculation presumably is for a polynomial with the same stiffness.
Yes.
So
right.
One piece is much more stiff than the other.
You assume that if it's in the thermodynamic limit where everything goes to infinity, it's not going to change. It just changes the effective length, and it will enter into this G somehow, which it's not going to change.
It's not clear that it will not change self-avoidance factors between the different groups.
That it will not?
I mean, there's also the parameter that presumably goes in something like epsilon expansion is some kind of self-avoidance.
Right, sure.
And it's not clear to me that the effective VGL coefficient or whatever that describes that in the continuum theory is the same between segments that have different resistance.
No? I don't think that is going to enter into the exponent. It may enter into the scaling function, but...
Mm-hmm. But what we're all arguing about is how close you have to get to the transition
right.
Before you see
it. Right.
All these things are saying that it's really close.
Yeah, it's not going to change the exponent, I think. It's just going to change the scaling function, maybe. Okay.
In an extreme limit, you could have each one of them have a different persistence length, and then you have a problem in the field of random networks.
Okay, that's a different... Random network, you mean...
If each segment, I give a different persistence
length. Right.
Then it seems to me that that's...
Well, I'm interested in this diagram that I'm talking about, so it's not going to be, you know, you have these two parameters, it just changed the effective, you know, ratio of the length. I don't think it's going to change much. So let me just finish.
Question.
Yeah.
Going to infinity, I mean, you say that the single loops are going to infinity. Is this true, or one could also think of that there are...
No, I'm not saying that. No, I'm not saying that. I'll this is a general result. Let me just now apply it
supposing
to the...
Supposing that the loops are getting very long.
Yes. Yes.
Also, the number of loops might become long, whereas the length of the loop remains finite in the thermodynamic limit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that this should...
Well, it has to be... long enough that you can, you know, that you can apply these formulas for the entropy. let me go a little bit further because I am going to enter into this question of size of the loop, and then we can discuss it. Okay, so the question we are interested in is the following. We have this kind of configuration. I want to ask, what is the entropy of this configuration? And according to the formula that we have, it goes like, this is L over 2, L, so it's S to the power L plus 2L, that's the total length of the network, times L plus 2L to the power gamma G minus 1, where gamma G is the gamma G of this particular configuration, which we know, times a scaling function of L over L, little l over capital L. Now, we are interested in the region, now, that little l is much smaller than capital L, that is, the loop is much smaller than the rest of the chain. We'll see that it's self-consistent because the transition is first order. So this is the rest of the chain, and this is one loop. So we are interested in that limit. So in that limit, this function, scaling function, can play a role that has to be taken into account. So what you do is you look at this in the limit of L much smaller than capital L, so you can ignore it here, and you get this. And then, clearly, in that limit where this L is much smaller than capital L, then this clearly the dependence on capital L has to be of the form S to the L to the gamma, where gamma is the gamma of a line. Because if you have a small loop here, it doesn't care. I mean, the dependence on capital L has to go like L to the power gamma minus 1, where gamma is the gamma of a line and not the gamma of this particular diagram. And therefore, this means that this G of Z has to scale like X to the power G of X has to scale like gamma G minus gamma in order to give us the right behavior as a function of capital L. Now, if you do all this, you end up with the following, and that's basically the net result, that the number of configurations of this diagram is S to the L to the gamma minus 1, that is the number of configurations of the rest of the chain, times some number of configurations of the loop. So it decomposes into a product, which is a very nice thing. It decomposes. And the C is now going to be just gamma minus gamma G, where gamma minus gamma G is just the difference between the gamma of this thing minus the gamma of this diagram. Okay, and we have these formulas for gamma and gamma G, and basically C turns out to be D nu times minus 2 sigma 3. You put the numbers there, and what you find is that in two dimensions, it becomes 2 plus 13 over 32. In 4 minus epsilon, it goes like 2 plus epsilon over 8. It goes above 2. And in three dimensions, it goes like roughly like 2.1, which gives C larger than 2, which means a first order phase transition. This was a very nice numerical work by Grasberger and co-workers, and which see this first order line. Just last view graph. I think this result gives also the loop size distribution, which is something very nice to have. It turns out that the loop size distribution at the transition, there is a jump. It's a first order phase transition, so the loop size, the average loop size is finite at the transition. But there is a critical element to it, that is the loop size distribution at the transition goes like 1 over L to the power C, where C is, our C is the 2.11, which means that there is a very broad distribution at the transition. So there is some critical aspect to this transition. In particular, for example, L squared diverges at the transition, although L average is finite at the transition. Yes?
Would this be true also if C was less than?
No, but then you will have higher moment, which will diverge. No, this has to do only, the divergence of this is because C is between 2 and 3.
Yeah, but suppose it's between 1 and 2, do we still have this kind of system?
No, if it's between 1 and 2,
normalizable, okay.
Yeah, if it's between 1 and 2, then even, yeah, it's not normal.
Yeah, it will have a finite degree.
Yeah.
But is it still true in that case?
That L squared?
That the distribution looks like that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to say. There are a lot of things one can use. We are trying to look at problems of unzipping, applying forces to this problem, and I will not talk about it.
Study the multi-loop case using this.
Right, we did that.
Does it give? I mean, it's not obvious that it is the same because the weights are not just multiplicative in this general form.
You get. We can do that, and you get one of two results: either this or a different formula where weights again larger than C becomes larger than 2. There are only two. You see, because it's a difference between these two lines like that. I mean, if you have some loops here, and it's the same loops which appear here, they cancel each other. And I can show it to you. You can do that. Yes.
Usually, if you've got some boiling problems, you can change the conditions, either the temperature or the solvent, in such a way you get to the theta point and then self-avoidance.
Right.
Doesn't
right.
Matter. Right. Does that happen in this problem too? And so, can you actually change the order of the transition because you sort of
can't? Sure. If you can, if you can tune, but then you have to tune parameters such that to tune the self-avoidance to zero, then of course,
So experimentally.
If you can do it with the theta, right.
Yeah, so experimentally, what's the situation?
Right, right.
Question.
I don't know. No, look, this has not been studied near you have to tune. To get to the theta point, there's a lot of tuning you have to do. And okay, this has not been done. I don't know. But that's an interesting thing to do.
If you take this model, sort of this effect seriously, and then you can pull out some length, because experimentally we know that the width of these individual melting domains corresponds to a sequence of lengths, a few, couple hundred base pairs. So, and you said that if you take into account this loop-loop interaction, then the average loop size is also finite. But can you actually pull out a number that can be compared with the experimental?
We haven't tried that. One should be able to do that.
To put actual numbers,
right?
Also
right.
Can narrow the transition really tremendously.
Yeah.
This loop initiation.
Yes. Of course. Of course.
Yeah. Yes. We still have that. So that suppresses the signal.
Is it understood correctly? The main effect taken into account is that two loops cannot make a stupid warning for.
Right, right.
But it is not taken into account, as far as I understood, the topological restriction. Two loops
cannot. You're right.
In one another,
right.
Which must enhance what you are saying. I think significantly.
Here we take into account basically all topologies.
You don't exclude.
I don't exclude. No, we don't exclude. No, we don't exclude.
From your point of view, what will be the effect?
I think it's not going to change C. There are some studies that show that the number of configurations with and without knots. Go with the same C. There are some estimates, very extensive, it's numerical work, which shows that the C does not change.
I think since the talk was significantly longer than 20 minutes, we should go on. David is around still for quite a while, so.
Yeah, okay. So. Yeah.
Next time I do the talk, I'll ask David to give the introduction. Like swallowing it? Or?
Yeah. Well, it's there. It's there.
So what do I do with this? And then? On the nose? Yeah? Okay. So I will present another kind of approach to the same problem. Some work that I did with Thomas Garel and Cécile Montus. So the model is slightly different, probably in the sense, is there a pointer somewhere? Yes. In the sense that, so it's the same problem, so I'm not going to do any introduction. I assume a single binding energy, so it's a homopolymer model, no AT, GC, whatever. I will assume no stiffness, and to simplify things, I will work in a continuous model and no mismatch. So this is quite standard assumptions. And so if one doesn't put, so this is another way to formulate, actually it's the identical to the Polancheraga model. If there is no excluded volume effect, you can represent each chains as a trajectory in the continuum, R1 of S, R2 of S, they interact like this. With a short-range potential, which represents the hydrogen bond, so it's short-range, it's attractive at short distances and repulsive at very short distances to account for the excluded for the hardcore repulsion at short distances. And the partition function in the continuous model can be written as an integral over all trajectories for the chain R1, R2, something like this. This is the Brownian, so this is like a chain or elasticity constraint. And this is the energy interaction between monomer S of chain 1 and monomer S of chain 2. And we take something like this. So this is very simple. And in order to solve this model, which is really known, I would say since Schrödinger probably, something like that. You go to relative coordinates. Relative coordinates R1, so center of mass and distance between the two chains. And in these new coordinates, the partition function is just given by this simple expression. This is the center of mass, which decouples because the system is translationally invariant. This is the relative coordinate chain constraint, and this is the interaction term. So this is, you recognize here, this is a Feynman path integral, and therefore it's equivalent, if you introduce a quantum Hamiltonian H, which is minus 2, so you read it off here, minus 2 A squared over 3 Laplacian plus beta V. So then what you want to do is calculate, if I assume that the two, the initial two origins of the two chain are stuck together at some point, so that's the partition function that you calculate. And when n goes to infinity, you know that this integral, this matrix element is dominated by the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian is just solving the Schrödinger equation in this Hamiltonian. So it's well known, this is depending on the depth. So this is multiplied by beta, which is the inverse temperature. So depending on the width, on the depth of this potential, which is governed by beta, you will have a bound state or no bound state. And this is really, in standard terms, the denaturation transition of DNA viewed in this approach. So then the partition function takes this form, and where E0 and Psi 0 is the ground state of this. And this is absolutely identical to very simple models of polymer adsorption, wetting of a substrate, or whatever. There are hundreds of problems which are formulated like this. And you can use for, so to solve, if you want really to solve it analytically in simple form, you can use either a square wave potential like this, or you can use a delta potential at finite distance from the wall. And the result is what I said. If beta V0, so the width which enters is beta V0, which is the here. So if it's deep enough, then you have native DNA. And if this goes up, when the potential, so when the temperature increases, there is no bound state, and therefore the DNA is denatured. You can show, of course, that the transition is second order. It's exactly the same as in Poland-Chiraga. There is no latent heat. And it has exponent alpha equals 0 with a jump in the specific heat. In this model, the specific heat at high temperature is 0 because there is no thermal anything. And the transition is second order, as I said, and it's even more second order, if I may say, if you put in this order. That's a general argument due to Berker, that when you have a transition, disorder can only smooth it out if disorder is strong enough. So in any case, in that case, it applies. So now I will show you how one can try to introduce excluded volume. So in order to introduce excluded volume, I will consider only interchain excluded volume, which means I will consider excluded volume between the monomers of the two chains. I don't consider excluded volume between points of a single chain, because for a simple reason, which is that it's non-perturbative. But if I you'll see that one gets a lot of effects by just considering the repulsion between chain here and chain here. So the essential point of excluded volume is that it doesn't couple monomer S to monomer S, but if you introduce it as an excluded, as an interaction, as an Edwards-like model, it couples any model, any monomer S of this chain with any other monomer on the other chain. So it's like a density-density repulsion. So it's much stronger, it's sensitive not only to the two same monomers, but also to the vicinity, to all the monomers which are going to be around this one. So in that sense, it's much stronger than... I mean, in this V, there is already a simple repulsion, SS repulsion, which is short range. So this repulsion is short range, but it's a repulsion between S and S prime. And it's a short range repulsion. So this is really the excluded volume effect. So again, what one does is one goes to relative coordinates. And when one goes to relative coordinates, so the first two terms, these two terms will generate again something like r dot square and v of r of s. And now there is an additional term which comes here, which depends on the center of mass coordinate because it is not translationally invariant in the sense it's globally translationally invariant but not locally. So essentially, this is still an exact type of result. The partition function takes this form with an effective potential W, where e to the minus W is the integral with the capital R. Capital R is the center of mass coordinate. And this is the delta function, which is the Edwards delta function, written in the center of mass and relative coordinates. Now, if the chains are unbound or weakly bound, then the excluded volume, what I expect is that if I am in a regime of weakly bound or non-bound, this excluded volume effect will be small, and therefore I can treat it perturbatively. And asymptotically, the perturbation theory should be okay. So if the two chains are on average far enough, if R is large enough, then I expect that it's absolutely valid to treat that in perturbation theory to any order. Then what you do is you expand this in perturbation theory, then it's standard calculations in polymer theory, and the result to lowest order can be calculated. You have to calculate this expectation value with a Gaussian weight, like this, and the result comes out here. Essentially, W, the effective potential induced by this Edwards repulsion, looks like a Coulomb potential, so I wrote it in dimension D. It goes like 1 over R to the D minus 2. Therefore, in 3D, it goes like 1 over R, and in with a constant alpha, which is given, which is proportional to the excluded volume parameter and has some other things. So the main result of this approach is that the effect to lowest order, and at least at large distances, the repulsion, the effective repulsion due to the excluded volume in 3D is essentially a Coulomb repulsion. And this is due, of course, to large loop, large extension. So it's long range because the chains can wander laterally as much as they want. Now, if I go to the Schrödinger analogy of before, the potential, the Hamiltonian is replaced by the free Hamiltonian plus this Coulomb potential, which is here. And this Coulomb potential, which looks like this, if I add an attractive part at short distances like this, the result is a potential which has a dip here. And then you can show that the transition is first order. Actually, this problem is very well known in nuclear physics. It's fission or fusion in nuclear physics. This is there. It's real Coulomb potential, and when you solve the Schrödinger equation, they call it the Coulomb barrier or whatever. Yes.
Your W are average over S, but the Schrödinger equation is equal time proportion.
Sorry.
This W is defined as average.
Average over.
Oh.
No. What happens? Sorry.
You have non-equal time interaction somehow.
Yes. So the W of R of S in principle is a non-local function of R of S, but you can show quite easily that. I didn't want to go into details, but at you can show that you can expand this non-locality, and the dominant term is just 1 over R.
And the non-local part is not?
It's not important. It's really subdominant. Yes. So, of course, when you have this Schrödinger equation with this Coulomb repulsion, you go to spherical coordinates, and then it becomes a standard problem of quantum mechanics. And in order to see whether the transition is first order or second order, what you do is you look for bound states at zero energy. If there is a bound state at zero energy, then it's a sign that the transition is first order, because then you have coexistence between a bound state and denatured state. And of course, this problem with long-range potential has been studied by many, many people. I think you did some things, Michael Lasik and Reinhard Kipowski. So there is a whole literature about that. And if you look at this equation at E equals zero, you see that the solution asymptotically is a Bessel function, which behaves like e to the minus square root of r over lambda, where lambda is some kind of correlation length, which is finite. It's independent of it's pi a4, where a is the monomer length over 72g, where g is the excluded volume. And you can calculate a latent heat, which is related. The latent heat is the discontinuity in the entropy, which is related to some integral of the ground state free energy, and a few things like this. What is interesting is that below the critical temperature, the partition function, below the critical temperature, the wave function decays exponentially with a correlation length psi, which diverges. However, usually in critical phenomena, when the correlation length diverges, one starts seeing here power law. But here it turns out that the correction to this is the square root of r over lambda, where lambda is finite. So this disappears, and the leading correction to that is the square root of lambda, which takes over at Tc. So there is one correlation length which diverges, but however, still the transition is first order. And one can calculate also forces by applying a force between the two at the two endpoints, etc. And one finds a.
Can you explain more about that? So you mean you didn't know the parameter that jumps, but the correlation
Do I have another parameter? Okay, all the parameter is the I don't know, like the average distance between, or the inverse average distance between the. So it will jump, yes. At the transition, it's finite because there is this bound state, so everything is finite, and above it's zero.
Something I'm missing, if you include also the intra-chain repulsion,
yes,
then you would presumably go back to this model Michael Fisher tried to do, but that second order, why is it that yours?
Because, essentially, is there? Okay. So I will maybe. So essentially, this is my last transparency. Okay, so what you have is, you have the, what one monomer sees here is not only the repulsion from monomer S.
You do allow different.
Yes, okay, of course. Okay. It's a delta of R1 of S minus R2 of S prime. So one monomer sees the repulsion, so it's coupled to the density.
I have a question about the perturbation theory that you did.
Yes.
Because what are the criteria for when that perturbation theory is valid? Because usually, like when you do the sort of model, there's a criteria depending on the concentration and semi-dilute regime. And
so, but here I have two chains, so the notion of concentration is.
No, but during the transition, there's going to be many loops and they're going to be close together, and so you have to worry about whether. The perturbation expansion is valid. I was wondering if you get different regimes, for example, if you use a different way to treat the fluid model.
Well, the only way I could answer your question is by going to second order perturbation theory, I guess, and see if it's small or if it's not small or so. But then, of course, if you go to second order perturbation theory, you cannot make it as a as an effective potential acting on the, it's not an effective potential acting on the Schrodinger equation. It's only at first order perturbation theory that you have this nice property.
Yeah, I know. And what happens if you try to do this by a self-consistent?
Yes, you could. I haven't tried. But it has to be inhomogeneous self-consistent field theory. Then you have to do it numerically. I don't know how to do self-consistent field theory analytically. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it usually works pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be, yes. So this is...
Is it clear that by not taking into account the interactions within a chain, you don't change the physics of
No, I don't know. Yeah, so
it can phase separate. I mean, it seems that you can have a kind of phase separation between the two chains, since each chain does not self-avoid itself, while it self-avoids the other. So you can change it between.
On the other hand, if the transition is first order, it's dominated by loops which are not very large, so excluded volume effects within one loop are not so important. What I wanted to say is, of course, that when you have a potential 1 over r to the d minus 2, in the Schrodinger equation, it's irrelevant in dimensions larger than 4. For d larger, because the dimension of the gradient is equal to 2, so when d equals 4, essentially this repulsive Coulomb potential doesn't play any role, and it's like the free Schrodinger equation in d larger than 4. And you can see that in D larger than 4, it's like in Poulenc-Chiraga, the transition is first order. Without the in D larger than 4, without the Coulomb repulsion, it's first order. Now, to answer your question, if it's small loops, then self-avoidance doesn't matter so much. Inter-chain self-avoidance is not a big...
In the perturbative regime, is a bit more important.
If you want to compare this approach with other approaches, I guess you can do the following. You have two chains which are have a completely repulsive contact potential.
Yeah.
So they will be together. And then you just fix, so you have take two chains of the same length and pinch the endpoints.
Yeah.
And then use your, this excluded volume effect and see what sort of excess entropy you get. And this, then you can...
That's easy, as I just have to remove the short-range potential.
Then you can get this exponent.
Except that there is no ground state dominance in the... So you have to be... it's a little bit more complicated because when there is no bound state, the approximation which tells you that z can be approximated by e to the minus n is 0. So you have to calculate phase shift, you know. But it's because you need the density of state.
You can really get the loop entropy with your interaction.
Yes, yes.
Then one can compare with other approaches.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Another thing is, of course, in all these approaches, the introduction of disorder is fairly simple. It just amounts to as so in the original model, introducing disorder would just amount to put a random psi of S in front of V, which is the which would define. I mean, if you take for V a square well potential, you could say that there is psi of S, which is which takes two values depending on the base pair. And then if you play all this game, you can play all this game with psi. Then if you put a psi of S, which is random, it's equivalent to a problem which was discussed yesterday, which is the also equivalent to the weighting of a random substrate. And in our simplified approach, it's just the same problem with a 1 over R, in addition, a 1 over R repulsive potential, which has not been solved, of course. It's a little bit more complicated. So that's
all. So you said the wave function and the exponential.
It's exponential, but with square root of r. The wave function exactly at the transition is not e to the minus r over psi, it's e to the minus square root of r, so it's a stretched exponential if you want, and lambda is finite at the transition. Because you just solve this equation and...
So, well, that is different from what David said, right? Because he...
Yes, yes.
The first order because absolutely. It was still the power law, but...
Yeah, yes, here everything is finite.
So the probability distribution of the length of the loop
is completely different. Yes, probably corresponds to an exponent which is much larger. Actually, I don't know if you can even define it in terms of power.
Because
no, it reports large loops, I think. Yes.
Yeah. It's consistent with that.
Yeah, but it's maybe not exactly the same model. No.
I think it's not the same model. Because you don't take into account interactions
within loops.
Within the chain. Within
yes,
the chain.
Within, yeah. No, it's really the repulsion between the two chains.
In both of the models that we just have presented, presumably you can calculate the light scatter and the signatures of the loop interaction
talking about talking about self-avoidance in RNA. This is a slightly different problem from what we've just heard about, but nonetheless, it's going to be another treatment of self-avoidance. However, the last two talks dealt with it in a very detailed, very precise way. What I'm going to do here is the simplest possible treatment And the reason we're doing something so simple is we're going to be aiming to get the full phase diagram of RNA structure. So we want something that's globally soluble in an analytic fashion throughout the phase diagram. Okay, so the model that we're going to be using involves just two elements. The first is the energetics in the bonds, and the second is entropic terms arising from the entropy. As you all know by now, RNA is a heteropolymer made up of bases A, U, G, and C. They like to form Watson-Crick pairs and form helices, A pairs with U and G pairs with C. So the total amount of energy in a bond is epsilon ij. I and j run over the length of the polymer, and epsilon takes on values depending on the AU or GC pairings, or a more complicated model would include stacking between AU and GC base pairs as you move along the chain. For the purposes of this talk, however, we're going to be treating it as a homopolymer, much as was done in the previous two talks. Characterized by a single energy epsilon naught, which can be taken sort of an average over the ensemble distribution. In principle, you could also include a disorder delta epsilon, which Ralph and I guess other speakers talked about yesterday. And you can also include a specific energy U, which characterizes the preference of the polymer for a particular native structure. So RNA is known in biology. A number of RNAs form functional structures such as tRNAs or ribosomal RNAs, which have to fold up in a certain way in order to form some biological function. And in that way, they're analogous to proteins. And so the phase diagram that we expect for these RNAs is sort of a is an analog of the one that you would expect to find for proteins. In terms of entropic terms, we have to include two different things. The first one is a spatial entropy, which is associated with the loops. These loop structures are single-stranded, and therefore they're floppy. They have very short persistence length. This is the entropy that was dealt with in the last two talks. In addition to that, there's going to be a branching entropy, which is different in RNA from in DNA. In DNA, there was just the one structure, which here would be associated with a native structure, where at low temperatures, you just form the single long double-stranded helix. Here, however, there's the possibility of forming structures like this. Okay, so we sort of know what we're looking for. We're going to be looking for the phase diagram in the plane spanned by the temperature, which characterizes sort of an overall affinity of the chain for itself, and the specificity, which measures, in some sense, the preference for a particular structure. So at high values of the specificity, you expect only native bonds to be formed, and you'll have a well-defined functional RNA structure. At lower values, you have a number of possible phases. At high temperatures, there's basically a denatured phase where all bonds come undone. I'm going to treat it as a GO model interaction where each monomer has a particular pair that it wants to pair up with. So everything has a uniform attraction for everything else, but in addition, certain pairs will have an additional energy for their contacts.
That's U0? What's U0?
U0 is this additional energy, yeah. But more about that in a moment. So at lower values of this U0, you have the denatured phase, and then as you cool down, you go into a molten phase where you have these non-specific bonds formed, but you can rearrange them, and the polymer can take on a number of competing structures. And then, of course, at lower temperatures, there's the possibility of a glass phase, which was, again, the subject of talks yesterday. Okay, so Ralph, yesterday...
Can you put it for a second?
So Ralph yesterday talked about the effects of this delta epsilon. The idea here is that you're given some sequence for the RNA, and then you have to get these coarse grain parameters, epsilon naught, U naught, and delta epsilon out. How you do that is a little bit of a mystery, but in principle, the phases will be the same regardless of how you do it.
The molten phase is what Ralph called the liquid phase yesterday, is that right?
What, who called
it? You called it the molten phase.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The liquid phase at some point.
Yeah.
What is the order of transitions along this line?
It'll turn out that this one and this one are second order in this particular model. But up here, the native to denatured, which is analogous to the DNA transition that you saw in the previous two talks, is first order.
Go on to the second.
The other ones are second.
All the
other. I'm not talking about this one here.
You have this specificity, again, it's only between one and another one, or there is a whole group that...
Each, it'll be more clear later, but basically every monomer will have a pair that it wants to form a bond with. Yeah.
What was the single parameter you know?
What's that?
I think the question is, what is the single parameter you
know? U0 is the additional energy that you give to the bonds for these preferred bonds. You define a set of pairs which occur in the preferred structure, and you give each of these bonds an additional energy U0.
So the same U0 for each of the
Yes, exactly, yeah.
In the experimental work, how do you tune up this U0?
That's a property of the sequence. So, for example, you expect that structural RNAs like tRNAs and ribosomal RNAs have a high value of U0, whereas things like messenger RNA will have a lower value.
That's the overall sequence.
Right, yeah. It's some property of the sequence.
But if it's a property of the sequence, then I don't see how it could depend upon the purpose for which the sequence is used. Yeah, it's still the question of an AA bond that you know is an A. I'm sorry, an AT bond that you know is an AT.
You have to think of these as coarse grain. Right, these are coarse grain parameters.
Right, versus the average of any pair of bases. So
right.
It seemed that making distinctions of mRNA versus tRNA versus.
You have to think. You have to look at coarse grain parameters. So when I talk about these epsilon knots and U knots, you're looking at not a single AU pair, you're looking at a group of pairs.
Right, but it seemed it would be sort of more composition dependent than anything else, and there's no reason to suggest that the composition would be overly variable.
Well, for example, if I just had an AU repeat, right, that's much different from...
Right, that's what I mean, it's composition dependent.
Yeah. But that will also determine the structure. Some RNAs fold, some don't. So yesterday there was some talk about RNA's secondary structure, which is, of course, doesn't have to do with the three-dimensional folding of the polymer, as is the case in proteins. It just has to do with the actual bond configurations, and in particular it deals with a secondary subset, of these bond configurations, which allow configurations like the one up here and disallow ones like the one pictured down here. So basically ones up, like the one up here says that for any pair of bonds, I and J and K and L, either I and J are nested within K and L, as is the case for this pair, or else they're completely disjoint, as is the case for this pair. A pseudo-knotted structure is one like what you see at the bottom here, which are not included in the calculations that we'll do. And basically, these amount to structures whereby once you form one helix, to form this other helix, I have to take the rest of the polymer and loop it through the eye of the needle. Okay, and it's hard for a camel to get through an eye of a needle, and it's even harder for a rich man to get to heaven. So we can just ignore these structures. In fact, they do occur in nature. They occur very rarely for RNAs, and when they occur, the pseudo-knotted bonds tend to be few in number, just because the number of them corresponds to the number of times you had to pass through that hole. Okay, so we're going to start with a simple homopolymer model of RNA. Like I said, just dealing with an overall attraction epsilon naught, which is uniform. And the way we're going to deal with it is by applying a propagator method. This was done first with Degen in 68, but it has its analog in terms of the summation of the series in the work of Poland and Shiraga and also Fisher. So in this work, you take the analogy of the partition function with the propagator, and then you can write the partition function for the polymer, or the propagator for the full polymer, just as being the diffusive propagator, plus the diffusive one with one interaction, plus the one with two interactions, et cetera, where each of these interactions involves a copy of the propagator itself, and also comes in with a Boltzmann factor associated with epsilon naught. So this gives you a simple self-consistent equation in Z of mu for which there is an exact solution. And the result is that from this Z of mu, I can calculate things like the average fraction of bonds, or average fraction of monomers which are bonded as a function of temperature. And of course, you get a helix coil transition at low temperatures, it rises up to 1. At large temperatures, it falls off to 0. But you never get a true phase transition. You can just associate a denaturation temperature with the halfway point. Although this transition can be fairly steep, there is no true transition. And the reason for that is that there's always an overcounting in this propagator function. The overcounting basically comes from the fact that you always add in the interactions on top of the diffusive propagator itself. So no matter how repulsive the potential epsilon naught may be, you only kill these terms and not the initial term itself. So the walks which cross themselves are always in the partition function. They don't come out. So this suggests a rather simple way to fix it, and that's, first of all, to consider a subtractive procedure in which the Boltzmann factors associated with the interactions are changed from e to the minus v to e to the minus v minus 1. Okay, this v here will just be some combination. It'll be a competition between a binding energy and a local entropy for the rearrangement of the plates as they come together. Okay, so if we take a real space path, or a path that the polymer can undertake, which is depicted here, that comes close to itself just once, we expect that path to have a weight of e to the minus v in the propagator, in the partition function. So that's obviously counted in the freely diffusive propagator with weight 1, and in the one in the propagator that comes back to itself once with one interaction with weight e to the minus v minus 1, and it's not counted in any of the other terms. So we see that adding these weights together, you actually get an idea that you can get out the right weighting. And in fact, it's possible to check that for all non-pseudo-knotted diagrams, you actually give the correct weighting to the paths. Okay, it's not true for pseudo-knotted diagrams. So once again, you can do a series summation just the way Degen did, and you get, instead of a factor of e to the minus v, you get this factor, which involves the e to the minus v minus 1 in the series, and also a ratio of volumes. Here, A is the length scale associated with the self-avoidance, and LC is the length along the backbone, the distance between monomers along the backbone. So this gives you, when you sum the series, it gives you some propagator for the self-avoiding polymer.
Excuse me, I'm just slightly confused. Will the subtraction procedure account for which particular self-avoidance?
I'm sorry?
Which self-avoidance of the different types of self-avoidance that are being discussed, does the e to the minus v minus 1?
Basically, we're just taking out the walk that was in the diffusive propagator. Right, so the
so
path...
You're trying to make the random walk of the diffusive propagator be a self-avoiding walk.
That's right, yeah.
But you're not taking into account self-avoidance loops.
No, self-avoidance and loops are included because, I mean, this is another random walk up here. This is another copy of Z inside the loop.
So you're just trying to modify the propagation for the
walks
by putting in a...
By changing e to the minus v to e to the minus v minus 1 and seeing that it gives the correct weighting for these non-pseudo-knotted diagrams, or paths.
You know, that's going to change the exponent of the walk as well.
Yes. I mean, well, in one case you don't get a self-avoidance transition, in the other case you do. Right, so if I introduce this term instead of this one, this term, as I just said on the last slide, gives you no self-avoidance, or no self-avoiding phase. This one does. Yeah?
When you say there's no self-avoiding phase, presumably I could have only, you know, RNA-like diagrams, but tune that interaction so it's repulsive instead of attractive.
Right.
And then I should get a phase transition, yes?
Yeah, but not as a function of temperature. That's as a function of what you set as your,
right,
your parameters. Right. So if I change the sequence, sure. Some sequences will be self-avoiding, some won't. Okay, so I said I wanted to get a global phase diagram, so that means that we also have to include this this specific energy.
Before putting the specific energy, I don't see what the RNA model is different from a standard setup point. If you cause rain a little bit, the model, and why the transition shouldn't be a standard tricritical. Because each monomer is attracting any monomer which is nearby, so it's like a standard attractive delta interaction with.
Except that this minus one actually removes paths from the Z naught that was there, right, from the diffusive propagator that you already had.
I'm speaking from a universality point of view. Isn't it just like?
I mean, whether the exponents will be the same.
Or the globally the phase diagram of this, without the U0.
The exponent should be the same.
Same as what?
Well, they're not, you mean the true theta transition?
Yes.
I mean, this is just a very simple treatment, right?
Yeah, no, but it's. Yeah.
It doesn't give the right exponent.
No, this I can do, but. But it's a question. Is it in the same universality view? The homopolymer RNA is it the same as a polymer in the Bats open? For a homopolymeric case, not specific to your model.
Uh-huh.
In general, if you take a polymer.
Oh, I see you're asking.
Is it very different from, or is it the same problem?
I think it should be the same problem. I don't see why it should be different.
You mean a theta point transition itself?
Sorry?
You mean a theta point transition itself?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not going to see a change of exponent in three dimension anyway. You really don't have to treat it acceptable as that.
Yeah.
You have to the data point.
I think if you had the right model, it should be the same.
Well, what you see at the theta point is you see that the three-body interactions that would normalize the second variable coefficient and cancel that out.
Yes, but if you're on
the... I think the same thing would happen here. You have to model the specific binding as being something like that third variable coefficient to change the sign. The second one. Well, I just thought my question again to you. So, are you just replacing the propagator in this propagator method?
Uh-huh.
You're just replacing the diffusive propagator by the propagator you would get from a self-avoiding chain. That's all you're doing. So the correlation function.
Well, except that it's got this it's this e to the minus v minus one can change as a function of temperature from positive to negative.
I guess it's this weight part that I didn't understand.
Okay, so the interaction that we're treating is a short range. Basically, you've got you imagine that there is some hard wall on the inside, and then there's a short range attraction, right? But this is, I mean, basically we reduce this to a delta function interaction, where you subtract off the path that comes within this region, and then add it back in something with this at this range that with the weighting associated with this potential. That's basically what we're doing with this calculation. Are there any more questions? Okay, so if we proceed and try to put in the native contacts, we want to add this bias in for a preferred structure. The simplest thing to do is to take a hairpin structure. This is what Ralph and Terry did in their 1999 paper, where the first monomer on the polymer is paired with the last one, the second with the second, the last, etc. So now the partition function for this whole thing can be calculated in the exact same way as just being a summation over the partition functions for the self-avoiding polymer. Here indicated by green loops, with interactions stuck in, which reweight the bonds that were already there with this new weighting associated with the native contacts. So you get this expansion in preferred contacts. So now we have a model that includes the two types of entropy.
Yeah,
Then it could also wrong pairing.
Wrong pairing.
Only correct pairing.
I only put the wrong pairings are already there. These are the wrong pairings, epsilon naught. These are the good pairings.
They
are there. Yeah. So this model now includes two forms of entropy. It includes the branching entropy associated with rearranging bonds. That's within each of these green blobs. It includes the looping entropy, once again, within each of these green blobs. And then in terms of energetics, it includes both the non-specific and the new specific bond energies. So we can go, so now we have the partition function, we can calculate the properties that we want. In particular, we can calculate the average fraction of bonds in the system and the average fraction of native bonds in the system. And here's the plot. Basically what you see is, you see projected into the base of it is the phase diagram that I started out with. You have the denatured phase, the molten phase, and the native phase. The denaturation transition here is a true transition, but it's second order as you go from molten to denatured, but it turns out that it's first order as you go from native to molten. So here's the plot. Here it is for small values of alpha. This alpha was just that parameter which related the self-avoidance volume to the volume associated with the distance between monomers along the backbone. So there's actually a jump in the fraction of native bonds here, which is too small to be seen here, but if I crank up alpha a little bit, you can see it. How am I doing on time? Okay. So just to summarize, we were looking for a model that was simple, and it would give us a global solution for the phase diagram of RNA. Okay, we wanted a way that we could treat self-avoidance that would give us this diagram. So we included energetic terms, both specific and non-specific, and entropic terms in terms of bonding and spatial entropy. And finally, we included this self-avoidance term. And we got the phase diagram in which you have a preferred structure at high specificity, denatured state at high temperature, and down in this region of the phase diagram, we get a molten sort of phase.
Why did you have no glass phase, which can be presented?
Glass. Well, this calculation does not give you a glass phase.
Why?
Well, maybe it can be improved to give you a glass phase. But I haven't done that, so.
Because actually the model, in any case, incorrectly folded model, molecules are the same in both worlds. What you're drawing the left down corner.
Uh-huh.
They're absolutely the same. And there you have last phase, and now you have up.
Right. Well, it may be possible to include this delta epsilon, or this range of energies, into this model.
The first phase diagram you show,
uh-huh,
why there's a glass phase here, and now this is
the... I was just trying to give the global picture, but now that I've presented the model, I just want to present the results that came from the model that I actually talked about.
There was a talk yesterday that I think you missed. That was the treatment of the glass phase. And essentially the result is that Pudding disorder is not that different from not Pudding disorder. The effect of sequence disorder is very weak for this kind of RNA pump. That's why.
I mean, this model here, you can't
really tell
the
glass
phase.
Yeah,
that's
why. Yeah,
but
this one,
you
can't
see
it. Yeah, but of this confusion.
Okay.
There's no...